everyone. I'll call to order the November 20th, 2018 work session for the Springfield Planning Commission. I'm just going to go ahead and say that we have complete attendance rather than going through calling for attendance. And we'll kick it right to our staff member, senior planner Molly Markarian, to discuss planning and zoning basics.
So this is kind of a little agenda of what I want to walk through with you guys tonight, cover a little bit about my background, and then talk about a little bit of the historical background of land use regulation in the United States, and touch on the legal basis for land use regulation, role of government, the federal, state, and local level, and then cover a few zoning concepts, and then we can talk about the article, any of you had an opportunity to read it. So a little bit about me. I know some of you. I'm a senior planner at this city. I currently manage comprehensive land use and infrastructure planning projects at the city. I've been with the city for 11 years, and over that time I've worked on affordable housing, community development, historic preservation, current development, so a broad range of endeavors. I worked on the Glenwood Refinement Plan update project down in this corner. I partnered with one of our engineers on the Millrace stormwater facility, and I've done a number of stormwater master planning projects. And currently, I am the city's project manager for the Main Street Safety Project, and I encourage all of you to participate in our online open house. It's live until December 5th, so spread the word to folks in the community. You all, I believe, are on our interested parties list, so should have gotten information about how to access that. All right. Let's see. So, this is a quote I find interesting about land use regulation that is said to be society's attempt to preserve icons and exclude aliens. And so land use regulation is really rooted in the public's desire to protect private property, encourage orderliness, and ensure stability and reassurance. And then if we look to the origins of land use regulation in the United States in the early 19th century, especially private citizens protected themselves via deed restrictions. Those are still in place today, but they certainly have limitations. One is that only the properties that have restrictive covenants get the benefits of the regulation, so communities can't control for collective issues like traffic or water supply. And then they can be limited in their duration and effectiveness, and then are difficult to enforce. So many localities move towards administrative enforcement of ordinances that are adopted through legislation. And by the end of the 19th century, most major cities had ordinances preventing property owners from harming other citizens or damaging property. And these are just some examples of early ordinances that really looked at, you know, health and safety as the root of those regulations. And I think it's worth noting that Houston is the only major city that continues to regulate land largely through private agreements, even though that's eroding and has evolved a bit over time. That's one holdout, so to speak.
Do you mind my asking? Mm-hmm. Tell me, when you say private agreements and deeds, can you expand on that a little bit?
So when, if a developer, for instance, develops a subdivision, and can place covenants on those properties that, you know, run with the land, like for a homeowners association, say, or for control even of park space, but it's not then enforced by the local governing body, it's enforced. There's no way really to enforce it.
Mostly by the HOA then?
Right, or through, you know, one, it's through the civil legal process.
Okay, thank you.
So the next wave of land use regulations in the United States were largely modeled on New York City's 1916 comprehensive zoning ordinance. So the previous ordinances would cover, you know, one certain aspect of, you know, a building or a land use district. But in the New York City, the 1916 ordinance combined land use, height, bulk, and then later revisions. There was a huge revision in 1961 that brought in density requirements and such. And so within 5 years of the New York City ordinance, there were 76 similar statutes, and then by 1926, 564 similar statutes, and so it just continued. In terms of the legal basis for zoning, we talk about police power. And so the power to govern implies power to establish suitable regulations protecting public order, health, safety, and morals of the community. So the power to police the community, so to speak. And the degree of the regulation is constrained, however, by the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment that look at takings and due process. So those are constraints. And comprehensive zoning ordinances have been attacked from the beginning as being unreasonable taking of property, dating back to the first zoning ordinances. And the Supreme Court established in 1926 that comprehensive zoning is a constitutional exercise of police power. So police power is not in the Constitution. It's power that's retained by the states, and so our local authority to police land use derives from our state constitutions. And starting in the 1920s, the U.S. Department of Commerce developed a standard state zoning enabling act and a standard state planning enabling act. And early zoning ordinances, such as the 1916 one in New York City, were fairly narrow in scope. They looked mostly at design and land use districts. And then by the late 1900s, 1970s, is when the more stronger mandates for planning came out in Oregon and California, Vermont, Maine, Florida. And then in terms of the federal government, even though that is the authority to police or to regulate land use is not through the Constitution, the federal government does regulate land use through other mechanisms. And for instance, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, in terms of its regulation of rivers and coastal zone management, that's where those regulations come down. Also, in terms of the federal government, anytime Congress appropriates funds, federal government has the right to demand that the recipient comply with certain requirements, and so that's where the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, comes into play in terms of requiring certain. Compliance with certain rules. This is not a complete list of all zoning elements or concepts, but it's just a sample of how zoning controls land use, and principally it's through the division of the community into districts. And then also, you know, looking, you know, throughout the 20th century, as there were changes in technology, then there are changes, you know, complementary changes in how zoning regulations morphed. And then in the 1960s and 70s, we began to see more, I guess you'd call it incentive zoning, or providing incentives to property owners to provide facilities that the community wanted, like a plaza or parking. So I didn't know if any of you wanted to maybe share any thoughts or observations from the article that was referenced in the AIS. I find it kind of interesting to examine the values at play in land use regulation and how they've changed over time.
When you introduced the subject, you were talking about restrictive covenants, and I find it real interesting in Oregon that for the longest time that many people could not buy land in Oregon, including Asians, people of Mexican or African descent, Eastern Europeans, quote-unquote gypsies, the Roma, and many others. And I believe there was a blanket law that removed all the restrictive covenants in, was it the 40s that was finally done by the state of Oregon, that removed all restrictive covenants of that like?
I'm not sure when exactly it was, but I do, yeah, I'm aware of that.
There are actually still restrictive covenants that have racial discrimination in them that are in place. So there may be a state law that said they're of no meaning, but those are still, I mean, you can still in Eugene and Springfield get copies of deeds that have those recorded and written on them. They're not enforceable, but they're still on paper.
Yeah, my property deed originally had some on subdivision.
I think one of the things, too, that it highlights, and something that planners and jurisdictions have had issues with for years, is the constant conflict between people that have the thought that they can do whatever they want with their own property, as opposed to people that are looking at the bigger picture and saying that we have to protect the land, whether it's my land or someone else's. So that constant conflict has been enforced for years, and it was noted in this document that you provided.
I thought it was interesting, too, that it really examined the difference between what typical Republicans and Democrats, where that soul comes from, where the difference of the land idea comes from. So I think that was on page maybe 3, but I thought that was really interesting that it actually dove into the party lines and how that has to do with land use. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty neat.
It also went in a little bit to how our regulations have become more complex and more costly over time, and I think that's something that this community is talking about right now in terms of looking at the development code and simplification and streamlining and things like that.
Well, I think there's a need for a certain amount of complexity simply because of all the factors involved, plus the fact that I think the people in Oregon are more aware of the environment and protecting it than a lot of other states, probably most all other states. So oversimplification becomes a question mark more than an absolute must, simply because I think you need to specify what you can and what you can't.
Need that balance, and that's what our elected and appointed officials are charged with doing.
Well, it's also interesting to think about, and you use the words protection of the land, but there can be also protection of use of land, right? So agriculture, forest land is protected for that use, but that is not necessarily, there's no rules about, there are rules, but there are different rules about how they go about doing that agriculture, which may or may not protect the land, but what, and what does that mean, and how do we impact that, and then those, how those can be easily eroded for other protections. So, like, for example, the legislature recently passed that in farm use zone land, if they have a historic house that the people don't want to live in anymore, but they are not supposed to tear down historic houses, so they can add an accessory dwelling, which is actually the house that they live in, because that's the one that's nice that they want to live in, but then they can use the original one as the accessory dwelling. But that expands, that's more building on farmland. So, and it's just interesting to think about all the pieces, and, you know, people like it when it helps them and don't like it when it restricts them. So how do you have the conversation and figure out the best way to do it as the government?
Well, it's always a matter of compromise, because the bottom line is the population is ever increasing, and it has to be accommodated. So it isn't a matter of, well, we're going to draw a line here and it never can be crossed. So it has to be a middle ground overall.
And there's, you know, continuous change in society and how we live too. Like, for instance, these increased forest fires that we're having, I don't doubt that we're probably going to see more restrictions on in-home wood burning as a result of, just in general, our air quality seems to be diminishing in from July through November, at least, certainly these past couple of years.
I thought it was interesting that they incorporated the Wealth of Nations as well as Tragedy of the Commons to a developing perspective, because, I mean, typically when we look at Wealth of Nations, we're thinking in terms of markets and in terms of commodities, whereas land can be viewed as a commodity, but isn't always. So it was interesting to see how that applied to, you know, laissez-faire economics, how it applies to commodities being different to how it could apply to the scarce resource of land.
I just enjoyed the presentation, because you came up all the way from, you know, when we were heading out west and there was no limits on land, and there was a lot of emphasis on that, and you know, Grace's perspective about different parties, and, you know, it's not so much that you can say, well, the Republicans are for land regulation, Democrats are, and vice versa. There's conflicting interests. For instance, we went through ADUs, and part of what we did is, well, let's make sure somebody's not setting up junk to trash your neighborhood because it's cheap. And so, you know, this is a bipartisan, this is an issue that affects everybody, potentially in a very positive way. Very enjoyable reading the history, by the way. I enjoyed that piece, that part of it.
Any other questions, comments?
Well, I'd like to pose a question to the commissioners who've been doing this for a while. As can you give some examples where you have had to weigh these different interests, and how do you make that decision then when you've got these different interests at play in the decision that's before you? If you just reflect on some of the issues that have come before you as a commission, and how you navigated that in the context of what you've just read and the history that you've learned.
I think the ADUs is one example. You know, you may remember a couple of years ago we did a couple of cell tower things, you know, where we said, we want you to make these things look like pine trees. Well, they don't look like pine trees, but does it look better than a cell tower if it's not 150 feet high? And I've been around driving, and yes, they do look better. No, they don't look like pine trees, but they're better. You know, and this is protecting, we do these things to protect the interests of our citizens.
I can think of one rezone we did off of High Banks Road that was for, I believe it was for the Bishop's storehouse for LDS, and that was a land use change, removing land that would normally have been for single-family residential, which of course we know there is a shortage of single-family residential in not necessarily land, but there's certainly a shortage of the supply. And so you balance the needs of the community, which is certainly a very good land use, mm-hmm. with so you're basically taking from one public good and giving to another public good. So you actually have to kind of weigh the particular public goods before you make your decision.
I thought the public input on the TSP was a great example of this, because we had plenty of people quite concerned with the black lines through their properties and adjacent to their properties.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that, you know, the purpose of those black lines is connectivity and trying to get a better social outcome for the city. But the problem that people have with those is that something's being drawn on a parcel that they own. And when something's drawn on a parcel that you own, regardless of whether that's a guarantee that it's going to happen, it could potentially change the market value, what people look at when they go to look to buy your house. So things like that, regardless of what it means, it people take into consideration. So.
Well, I think adding to that, so I was involved with the group that created the Springfield TSP and created that project list. One of the things I don't think was emphasized during the process that we went through is that the vast majority of those projects will never occur because of a lack of funding. And there's many cases where even projects that the public supports will never be funded for the same reason. Yeah. So I don't think that was highlighted to the public, that chances are the issue that you have a concern with isn't going to occur anyway.
Even if it does, not for quite a while.
Right, so, and then all kinds of new factors can play in at the time. Yeah. But I think another thing that's kind of interesting, and this isn't really something that was before the Planning Commission, is that I remember, Mike, a couple of years ago, you had voiced some concerns about those new warehouses on South 20th and all the trees that needed to be removed. And you were concerned about having so many trees removed just before they even started anything. Now, there's another example, because at South 42nd and Jasper, where there is a cell tower, they're going to create some mini storage units. And there's a whole row of fir trees that are over by the school. Today, they're all gone. Everything went down. And I know that there's a requirement to go through a process for tree removal, but sometimes you wonder, is it really necessary to just clear everything before you start a project?
Any other comments? We did have, and I proposed this in general, we did have a possibly an addition to the agenda, and I'm not certain whether that's going to be okay in this work session or not, but we do have a little bit of extra time before our regular meeting, and so I guess we could either adjourn or we could go ahead and add this additional agenda item, which was to discuss who would be most interested in being part of the governance committee for the code updates. And I don't know, would that be proper to introduce an agenda change at this time for this meeting?
It's not a public hearing that requires notice, so okay. I think you could add something to it.
Okay, so would everybody like to go ahead and discuss that since we have time before our 7 p.m. meeting?
Sure.
Consensus?
Well, my question is that something that would be covered anyway when his turn comes up, Mark?
Well, I
don't know whether we're getting ahead of you is what the question I have.
So talking under your regular agenda meeting tonight about the community engagement plan, that certainly is a small component of the community engagement plan, but I don't think the conversation I was going to request you have tonight later is directly having you talk about or decide about who you think will be on the governance committee. So I think it can be appropriate now to talk about it.
I also thought it'd be a good idea because I didn't see it in your packet. And then also, I believe we have two positions, and I know we have more than two people who are interested in it. So what I'd suggest would be the commissioners who are interested in it could briefly explain to us why they're interested in it, and then would it be appropriate for us to vote?
No. You should make that. You can't take votes or make decisions in work sessions. You can have discussion, and then in your planning commission meeting after you've approved the community engagement plan. So I would say in another tonight, because your CCI meeting will come after your regular planning commission meeting. Mm-hmm. I would say the next time that you convene after you formally adopt that plan, then you can decide to place someone on that.
And I know that the council is going to be talking about who they want as their representatives as well. Does the council decide who from the planning commission, or does the planning commission decide who from the planning commission is on the governance committee?
Then your community engagement plan doesn't specify.
Yeah, I don't think that we have guidance on that, and so I would at this point recommend that the planning commission offer up who you think would be best, and if council decides otherwise, they can do so, but at least you'll have provided input. I mean, Councilor Stoke?
No, I think that sounds right.
I'd recommend that we go ahead and take this time now for people to put forward their names towards the governance committee and explain why you might want to be on it, and then when it does come time to vote, we can do so.
I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, because Mark has not presented the details of what's involved in being on the governance committee. So whether a person says yes or no, dependent on the details, which haven't been provided yet. Unless we want to go through a discussion of what specifics are.
What time do we start our next meeting?
Seven.
Okay, so I say we got 35 minutes here that we'll either just walk, putt around, or we could get some work out of the way since we're here for a work session. I'm not sure, this is sort of a fair question for Christina. Is there any way that you could just present to us what the governance committee is, just in a work session way? Just tell us what the details on that are?
No, I think that's a topic for your CCI.
For the CCI?
Your CCI meeting is technically a different committee of the city, and their meeting was noticed for 7:35. So if you start earlier than that, then you're convening earlier than your notice. I did email out, if I can interrupt with my main alternative, I did email out about 4:00 some updates to the item that you will be considering at 7:00. And I have copies of that for those of you that didn't have time to that could be another use of that time, is to review that code. We only have a half hour for that item, so that's another.
I was just going to say, I'm happy to talk about it twice tonight, just giving them some information about it now and still talking about it formally under the CCI.
My concern would just be that if you accidentally said something here and you didn't say it later, then there's just different information and they're not convened as the CCI.
I personally would prefer to go over the updates, because there's updates to the updates that we saw. Some language was taken out and other language was added.
I didn't see those. It was pretty nailed this afternoon. So,
yeah, I think that makes sense. So we'll go ahead and postpone the discussion I was speaking of. So, yeah, if you could go ahead and lead us on that, that'd be great to see what the changes in your Exhibit B are.
Sorry to clarify, for you to take the time individually to read the review. I don't think that I can start my staff report until 7:00, because it's part of the public hearing.
Okay.
So, were you asking about the city council liaison person? That's what you wanted to do today. You were talking about the governance thing.
Well, yeah, okay, that's another subject. Yes, I was talking about the governance committee.
Okay, I thought you were talking
because
about
had,
the city.
We hadn't really had a discussion on that at this point. And rather to say I do or I don't without having the background on it, I think is a little premature.
Brenda, will
anyway, I think we've decided.
We need moving rooms.
Yes, we will.
Okay.
We can move over if you want.
Do you have to adjourn? We have to adjourn.
Adjourn the work session.
Oh, yeah, and I'm going to do it. So, if I haven't asked you, did everyone get their email other than Michael regarding the package from the district?
No.
You did not?
Well, I think there's an issue with my iPad that I was going to talk to you about.
Oh, that's a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see the 4 p.m., but that's...
Have you no, but you got the other one.
Yes.
Have you received any of my packets?
I went...
Instead of yelling across the room, I can come talk to you.
Yeah, we will be helping out this.
So is this thing that was handed out, is this what she's talking about that came out?
Yeah, that's...
Well, there's an email, too. I just now noticed it.
Oh, I believe that, but I mean, if this is it...
Same one.
Then I can read through this and...
Yeah, I mean, the one, read it.
That'd be good.
Do we take our review time over?
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dom's the people who invited are going to be... You're going to say only two kinds of...
Oh, see, I think she's got a different...
Oh, we have...
How about the chili?
That's all I thought I could collect them for. You still got a quarter running?
Yeah. So you said you got some for iOS update. So you're connected to the cities.
Yeah, the leftover is a brand new, right? Yeah.
Is your recorder still running?
Yeah.
Having the stuff in his bag in a second here.
Yeah. It's off, so have everyone's conversation on it.